Good morning, council.
Good morning.
This is the case of State versus Shane R. Melton. You may be seated before we start arguments, Mr. Trusinski. As you can see, we've got five members of the court here present on WebEx. Our justices Miller, Lerman, and Funk. So they will be participating and asking questions and so forth, just as if they were in the courtroom here today. While you are seated, please keep your masks on, but when you come forward to present, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. And with that, either of you, counsel, have questions at all? We will proceed then. Mr. Trusinski, good morning to you.
Good morning, counsel, and other members of the court. Thank you for having me here. The court didn't have to allow argument in this case and graciously did, so I appreciate that very much. My client does as well. I have to confess, I think we have an interesting, unique factual situation here, and I think perhaps that's why the court has shown some interest in it. I was put in mind of Professor Irving Younger. I don't know if any of you, 100 years ago when Court TV started, Professor Younger used to do these CLE deals.
I feel obliged to interrupt, notwithstanding the reference to 100 years, but I took Professor Younger for evidence.
Very good. So, and as an homage, I wore my suspenders. He always had suspenders on during his CLE things. But I remember one of his programs, and I've tried to find it on YouTube, and all the YouTube things is on his Ten Commandments of cross-examination. But this was an evidence seminar. And in that seminar, I think he was talking about hearsay and hearsay within hearsay, but he was describing a trial scenario that he had been in when he was younger. Mr. Younger was younger. And he said he got up and made an objection. The judge said, what are the grounds for your objection? And he said, you know, that just didn't sound right, judge. And the judge said, sustain. And I think that's what we have here. We have this just doesn't sound right scenario. We've got a situation here where the trial judge had five cases that he pronounced sentence on, and I think we had seven or eight different felonies that were being sentenced upon, and he entered a judgment in each one at the sentencing hearing, and there was a combination of what he said of concurrent and consecutive sentences.
Were all of the sentences, when pronounced, valid sentences?
I think there's an argument that no, they weren't. The class four felonies, when you look at the statute 29-2204 and in conjunction with 29-2204.02, I think they were probably not valid sentences because he did 2 years to 2 years. And I think the language of the statutes in compliance in conjunction with each other mandate that the lower term has to be less than the maximum.
And except for the ones that had that flaw, were the other sentences valid?
Valid on their faith, they were within the term of the felonies. So I'm not sure what Your Honor is getting at.
It's within the term, within the length, within the permissible limits
they were
of the sentence, and the other than any mandatory consecutives, they were either mandatory or either consecutive or concurrent as a matter of discretion.
Absolutely. That's up to the judge's discretion. I think the law is clear on that. The case law is clear on that, and the statutes are clear on that as well. The issue that came up that prompted my attention was, talk about hearsay. I'm talking to a colleague one day, and she says, hey, what did Judge Piccolo ever do with that case of yours, Melton? And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. So she related to me that she had overheard the judges talking. I don't know if any of you have ever been to North Platte. We are pretty informal there. We have a lawyer's room, which is adjacent to judges' chambers. she related to me that she had heard the two district judges talking to each other.
And in chambers? It was a discussion in chambers?
No, they were in the coffee
room. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And our, like I said, our coffee room is the judges' chambers are on each side lateral.
It's like the library of the chambers, isn't it?
Yeah. There's still law books there. They're very dusty because no one looks at the books anymore. But it is a room where the lawyers all gather, and the judges commonly are there as well prior to hearings. She overheard Judge Piccolo say, "Hey, I messed up. I meant to run all these sentences concurrently, and I did some consecutively." And the discussion, the colloquy between them was, "Well, tough luck. You can't do anything about it." So upon hearing this, I wrote a letter, which is part of the record here, because it was attached to the judge's order, which I'll tell you about. He entered an order saying, "Yeah, I messed it up. I meant to say everything should run concurrently, but Nebraska law doesn't let me fix that." So my letter, which he deemed as a motion to modify, the motion modifies overrule.
In your letter, you said you were going to file a motion,
correct? I did say that.
Yeah, but the motion was never actually filed. The letter was deemed to be the motion by the court.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's part of his order. And so we didn't have a hearing either. He entered his order without us having a hearing on this. But it's very clear from his order, he is absolutely clear that he messed up. And our argument,
the judge phrased it as an inadvertent mispronouncement.
Right.
And in his order, sort of tracking with some case law, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But when we read the record itself, I have a hard time with that characterization, because on five different cases, on a bunch of different counts, the judge makes a lot of different distinctions. Some of them are concurrent, some are consecutive. It's not a situation where everything was ordered to run consecutively.
Exactly.
And it seems like that may have been just a mistake. This seems like over and over, some of them were ordered to be served consecutively and some concurrently. How can we conclude that was a mispronouncement?
Well, because he told you, number one.
Why should that make a difference? Just from a policy standpoint, we don't want trial judges second guessing 10 minutes later, 20 minutes later, 20 days later, 20 years later. We don't want them second guessing. Why should we depart from the rule which we've had at least since I started practicing law 41 years ago, that once they leave the courtroom, you're done?
Right. If I may invoke Professor Younger again, commandments, the Ten Commandments cross-examination, this court seems to have a commandment, thou shalt not modify a sentence. Okay, but I would suggest it happens.
Is that in our common law? Would you agree it's in the common law and not in the statute?
You know, I'm too far removed from law school to be able to answer that. If you suggest it is, I'm not going to quibble with you about that. But I think the cases that have held that and pronounced that rule are distinguishable from this case. Most notably, in most of those cases, if not all of them, the corrected sentence is either attempted to be entered much further down the line, or in all of them, I think the sentence is deemed, or the attempt to resentence is a harsher penalty than a milder penalty. And I would suggest that the Constitution protects individual rights. And in this case, because this modification would lessen the penalty that my client is going to have to serve, that's a distinction. Maybe it's a distinction without a difference. I think it's a distinction, and I think due process demands that there either be a procedure where this can be done, or that that the court just orders it done and allows it under these narrow circumstances.
You may remember, Mr. Krasinski, that there used to be a statute that allowed a trial judge to modify a sentence later. You recall that?
I don't, but again, I'll take the court's word for it.
And ultimately, that statute was determined to be unconstitutional as infringing upon the separation of powers. Why wouldn't the remedy that you're suggesting here not only not be compelled by due process, but infringe on the separation of powers, which entrusts the executive branch with leniency and matters of clemency?
Well, I think they're different issues, and I think the due process issue overrides that, the separation of powers concern. I would like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wiss, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hey, please, the court. Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. The state maintains that this court lacks jurisdiction over this appeal, and alternatively, this court has jurisdiction and maintain that Milton's claims are without merit. As far as jurisdiction as set forth in our brief, we submit that this court lacks jurisdiction given that this appeal is not timely perfected. The district court's operative judgment in this case was entered on November 12, 2019, and Milton failed to file a timely poverty affidavit within 30 days of that judgment. This is a fatal defect and precludes an appellate court from acquiring jurisdiction, as our case law makes clear. In fact, this court itself issued a letter initially declining to docket this appeal in light of the lack of a poverty affidavit. A poverty affidavit was eventually filed, but not until December 16, 2019, more than 30 days after the operative judgment was entered. So we submit that the appeal was not timely perfected and this court lacks jurisdiction.
Hasn't the court, the district court, subsequently filed further motions, which did change its sentence?
It did. Our position is that the court's order on the motion to modify, as well as all of those subsequent amended judgments, were all unauthorized and therefore a nullity and did not result in a final appealable order or a final judgment.
If this court doesn't have jurisdiction over this appeal, does that mean it cannot reach that issue?
Well, I think you would need to probably address that issue, at least the order on the motion to modify, because the defendant's appeal, both the notice of appeal itself as well as their brief and arguments on appeal, purport to appeal from the original judgment from November 12th, as well as the order denying the motion to modify. So I think to the extent they are seeking to appeal from both orders, I think the court would need to at least address that. I think the correct result would be that the controlling and operative order is that first November 12th judgment, and to the extent that the court entered a later order on the motion to modify, that's a nullity. But I think, in my assessment, the court would need to address that and say that had no effect, so it doesn't vest this court jurisdiction.
What about the sentencing orders issued after the motion to modify was denied?
Well, I think those are similarly a nullity. I don't think those had any effect, given that the initial judgment entered on November 12th was final. It was valid.
If you're right and we don't have jurisdiction at all over this appeal, what is the path to reach correcting any of those additional sentencing orders that were entered?
Well, I'm not sure that, well, I mean, I guess you could address them in this opinion as well, to just point out that those are similarly a nullity. If you were going to address those subsequent judgments, if you were asking how would he get to the issue or how would this issue ever be raised or reached, I think that would probably have to be through a post-conviction proceeding.
So Mr. Melton is serving Department of Correctional Services sentences, correct?
Correct.
What is the Department of Correctional Services to do with the buffet of sentencing orders that we have in this case? Which ones are they to be followed?
I think that they should be going off the original operative judgment entered on November 12, 2019.
Have you checked?
I've checked online as far as the inmate locator. I didn't make a personal phone call to the Department of Corrections, but their website, inmate locator, reflects that he's serving 10 to 13 years, which is consistent with my calculations on the original judgment. Now, I would say I'm honestly not even entirely sure what the amended judgments did. There are 11 judgments in this case, but if I tracked them correctly, and I ran the numbers again briefly yesterday, I don't think the numbers actually change. So either way, I think the numbers, the aggregate sentence was the same, and the Department of Corrections is using the correct time frame here. But nonetheless, I would submit, if we're correct on the jurisdictional argument, that the November 12th order is controlling, that this court should nonetheless address the issue, and at least for the sake of clarifying the matter, for purposes of future litigation and for Department of Corrections, should clarify that those amended judgments are null and void and have no effect for purposes of the case now or
did the future. November 12th sentencing orders track in every respect with the sentences as they were pronounced?
I believe that they did. I know, looking back over my brief, I did not reread
the sentences. If they didn't, what are we to do?
If they didn't, well, to the extent there's conflict, obviously the oral pronouncement would control. I don't remember there being any conflict. The only other thing that would potentially arise there would be if the court didn't say something, does a default come into play, and does that create some sort of conflict? But I don't recall any conflict. I mean, if there is a conflict, obviously it's resolved in favor of the oral pronouncement. I don't think we have a situation where we simply can't tell it all. If that were the case, I think you'd have to remand for resentencing because we simply don't know what was opposed. But I don't think that's the case. I think worst case scenario, the oral pronouncement was silent on something, in which case a default comes into play and that's it.
Now, what's the date for the judgment? Is it the oral pronouncement or is it the written order signed by the judge?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first portion of your question, Justice Funk.
What is the judgment date? Is it the oral pronouncement by the judge or is it the written order signed by the judge regarding the first sentence?
It's the written order, the date that it's filed stamped by the clerk of the district court. By statute, that's the day the judgment becomes final.
All right, thank you.
Which statute are you referring to, just so we're all on the same page?
On that principle?
Yes, sir.
I don't recall. It's within the jurisdiction. I apologize. I don't have the actual statute in mind, but I know.
Are you talking about the rendition of judgment statute?
Probably, yes. I know that it specifically says that it shall become final on the date that its file stamped by the clerk of the district court.
I started to ask, opposing counsel suggests that some of the sentences may not have been valid when pronounced. Do you agree with that?
No, we respectfully disagree. As noted in our brief, that's referring to the class 4 felony sentences. The assertion being made is that those sentences are invalid because the minimum and maximum portions of those sentences were the same. The appellant's position is that they have to be different pursuant to 29-2204 and 2204.02. But that's precisely what we argued to you in Artis, and that argument was rejected. There was, at least in our view, there's a legitimate reading either way at the time. It was simply a matter of statutory interpretation, and we lost the argument. But I think that issue has been litigated and resolved. The minimum and maximum can be the same on a 4, 3, and 3A. So in our assessment, there's nothing invalid about the sentences imposed on those class 4 felonies.
If the trial court treated the letter from defense counsel as a motion, must we also?
I'm not sure that you would have to. I mean, in my assessment, there was no authority for that motion anyway, whether you, I don't know exactly what we would call it, a motion to modify, a motion to alter amend, motion to reconsider. I think when you look at our case law, you know, even the recent decision in Harris, as well as our prior decisions dealing with motions to alter amend, they aren't allowed in a criminal proceeding. They're allowed in civil proceedings or in hybrid type proceedings like DNA testing or post-conviction. But to me, whether the court allowed it or not, I don't think the motion itself was allowed, nor was the remedy that they were seeking. So I don't think it matters. I haven't answered your question. I don't know the answer to your question. If the court treated it that way, do you have to? The answer is probably no. If it wasn't actually a motion and the court treated it as such, I don't think you have to treat it as a motion. But we certainly we aren't taking issue with the fact that it was in the letter form and the court treated it as a motion. And I think the letter kind of contains some language as if it was being presented as a letter / motion. It's my reading of it. So we aren't taking issue with the district court's treating it as a motion.
Thank you.
If there aren't any further questions on jurisdiction, I'm nearly out of time. And I don't think I really have much to add to my brief on the merits of the claims. If you get there, we do believe the motion to modify was properly denied, given that our case law is clear. You can't modify a valid sentence once it's put into effect. Any attempt to do so is of no effect, and the original sentence remains. And then as far as the second claim on the merits regarding the class 4 felonies, I think I've addressed that in brief and again here today in response to Justice Castle's question. So I would stand on our responses on the merits in the event the court gets there. In sum, we would maintain that the appeal should be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. And alternatively, it's not. If it's not, we maintain that the operative judgment here is the district court's November 12, 2019 judgment, and that that judgment should be affirmed.
How do you respond to defense counsel's argument that it's just not fair, that it's just fundamentally, procedurally unfair that defendants can't come back later and ask for a modification in a sentence that was validly imposed?
Well, I guess first and foremost, that this principle can cut both ways. You could have a situation where a court erroneously pronounces something extremely lenient and realizes it after the fact and comes back and wants to say, whoops, I didn't mean to give you probation on it. Such a serious offense or such a low sentence. And the state might think that that's ridiculous, that we should be allowed to get that fixed, and we can't. So it cuts both ways. To the extent it could seem harsh, it's just the law, we apply it uniformly. So whether it's unfair or fair, it applies equally both ways. And then I guess the only other thing I would say is the only other really path or aspect in which you could analyze that claim would be through some sort of notion of abuse of discretion or plain error. And I don't think it qualifies as either, at least from an appellate court's standpoint. We've had situations come up before, they weren't found to be an abuse. We've had situations where the sentencing court misapplied the law, such as Iguallo, and we argued that that should be plain error because the court was wrong with respect to the law. And this court found that it didn't render the sentences invalid. It wasn't reversible error. The court made a mistake of law. Here it made a mistake of fact, I guess, if we're going to call it that. But it's not subject to change. The law operates uniformly across the board, and it has for some time. So I guess we don't view it as unfair to uniformly apply it. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the district court's November 12, 2019 judgment in the event you don't dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 1 minute and 36 seconds.
1 minute and 36 seconds, Mr. Trzynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I think counsel just largely made my argument. We're not asking the court to allow circumstances where a judge can change his mind and pronounce, this opens up a quagmire or a morass. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an extremely narrow factual situation where a judge admittedly misspoke. And as a result of that, a defendant's going to spend at least 3 more years in prison than what the judge intended. So I would submit that any effort, if the court goes along with us, this is not going to create a pathway of cases where defendants can be resentenced and sentenced more harshly, because that you run into other problems there. You run into double jeopardy type issues, and that has come up in other jurisdictions. And the Constitution, the Due Process Clause, I'm sorry, isn't there to protect the state of Nebraska. It's there to protect defendants. So defendants getting protections from the Due Process Clause mandate that in this case where a defendant has been prejudiced by a mistake, it ought to be able to be fixed, whether we craft a procedure or the court just makes a pronouncement that, yeah, this smacks of a violation of...
Has any other court held that there's a constitutional due process right to have your sentence reconsidered?
Well, I sure didn't.
Circumstance.
I didn't find it. I sure would have cited it for you. I don't have access to Westlaw like I did years ago, but I haven't found the case. And that I think that also works with me, because this is an extremely narrow circumstance where this is going to come up. It's a judge saying, boy, I fumbled the ball here, and I can't fix it because the state's case law doesn't allow me to do that.
But, is it a remedy that should be fashioned by the court? Or is it a remedy to the extent there's an issue that should be addressed by the legislature?
No, I think it's something that should be fashioned by the court, because we're dealing about a constitutional issue. It's not one that we need to go to the legislature and lobby to fix. And that's not going to do Mr. Melton any good anyway if the statute is somehow changed to allow this. So I think the court has to enter into this fray and follow due process and figure out what we're going to do here. But somehow this has to be able to be fixed. I didn't feel any questions on jurisdiction from the court. If there are any, I'm glad to answer them. I think we did cover them in the reply brief, because the state had raised the issue. I think I covered the jurisdiction issues. I don't see a jurisdiction problem here, and I assume that
staff counsel would have found a way to dump this case if the court believed there was a jurisdictional problem.
What is the appellant's current effective sentence? Is it the original sentence with the consecutive language?
Yeah.
Or is it the more recent ruling of the court with a concurrent language?
Just looking at the website, Nebraska Department of Corrections, they are going with what the judge pronounced at the sentencing hearing. So he has an effective sentence of 10 to 13 years.
However, if the corrections get sent an updated order from the court, are they going to ignore that order?
I think there's case law that suggests that that's the type of thing that if there's just another order, that can't be done. I think there has to be. I think we got to go back and resentence him or somehow issue a corrected sentence with the blessing of this body to make that happen.
So what do you suggest is the appropriate remedy for the amended judgment and the second amended judgments that were entered by the court that we have in our appellate record?
You do. And that kind of cuts both ways for me. I believe that the case law suggests that what the judge said at the sentencing hearing is what governs. But if looking at those later orders better vests me with and gets around the jurisdictional issue, I don't want to speak against them. But and frankly, I can't tell you what the difference is. The way those work in North Platte anyway is the county attorney drafts those orders and sends them to the judge, and the judge signs off. I had no input into those, never saw those.
Is that why there's a delay between the pronouncement of sentence and the filing of the sentencing orders? Because they are drafted by the prosecutor?
Yes. And the drafts don't come to defense counsel. They just go to the judge, and typically they're signed. And in this case, multiple times that exchange happened, and I didn't get notice of all those things.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you. I do ask the court to reverse and leave to the court's good judgment to figure out how you're going to do that.
Thank you very much, counsel. Please use your masks and distance on your way out of the court room, and please use that side door.